What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Hollengren. On today's show, Sofia Coppola abandons modern-day Tokyo for 18th-century Paris. We'll review her Marie Antoinette, plus listener feedback, Massacre Theater, and music by The Blue Jackets.
Plus the final film in our documentaries marathon, The Times of Harvey Milk, and our top five scariest movie moments. But first, Kirsten Dunst as the woman who allegedly let them eat cake.
You represent the future. All eyes will be on you.
She looks like a child. So, I've heard you make keys as a hobby?
Yes.
It'll be interesting to see how long she lasts.
What on earth is going on with that young couple?
It's a disaster.
On our last show, Sam, we discussed The Prestige and how director Christopher Nolan is clearly fascinated by characters undergoing existential crises. There's also a theme that runs through Sofia Coppola's three films, call it isolation or alienation or perhaps simply loneliness. The five doomed sisters trapped inside the Lisbon home in Coppola's 1999 debut, The Virgin Suicides, cut off almost entirely from the outside world save for trips to school. The dissatisfied Charlotte and Bob confined to a Tokyo hotel in 2003's Lost in Translation. And with her latest film, Coppola offers a revisionist take on France's legendary teen queen Marie Antoinette, a naive 14-year-old Austrian archduchess forced to marry the Dauphin Louis Auguste and conform to her new regal life stuck inside the Palace of Versailles. Sam, you are a fan of both The Virgin Suicides and Lost in Translation. Coppola is obviously mining familiar thematic territory here. Where does Marie Antoinette rank in her short but formidable body of work?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. You bring up this whole point. I was aware of it, too, as I was watching Marie Antoinette, that she does have a sympathy for these characters that feel a detachment from the reality. In fact, they start to see reality, the reality as almost a surreality. Mm-hmm. Certainly in Virgin Suicides, that's an intentional kind of thing,
sure.
Tonality. But certainly modern-day Tokyo takes on that sort of magical realism kind of quality as well. And what I think, what makes Coppola's film such a pleasure for me to watch is that she recognizes the absurdity of these places, but she doesn't treat that fact cynically, or she doesn't choose to make a mockery of those places, mm-hmm. really. And also, you know, she does have a sympathy for these characters, but she also has her characters try to make the best of that situation in their kind of odd, comic, lethargic way. It's not that she makes them out to be martyrs in some way or victims of this society, this larger society. I mean, you have a sense of sympathy for them as well, but they're not perfect creatures mm-hmm. either. They're not victims. And you brought up certainly Lost in Translation, which I liked a lot, but I remember not giving Coppola a lot of credit for that film. I really did enjoy spending time with the characters, but I gave a ton of the credit for that film to Bill Murray's performance. And I wondered, what would that film have been like without Bill Murray? And it's hard to imagine mm-hmm. it being a real success. I honestly look to Virgin Suicides as a better example of her her abilities, actually, as a adapter of a piece of fiction and as well as a director and a writer. Marie Antoinette, honestly, I think is one of the most exciting and interesting films I've seen all year. I loved it. I think it's her best film by far. And I think it made me realize, I think it was the film that really made me realize her powers of controlling that quality of here's a surreal world, here's a sympathetic character, and finding a real balance there where we see the reality through these characters' lives, but we're not entirely made to heroicize these characters or
right.
idealize these characters. Mm-hmm. And I love what she does in terms of this revisionist history. I think I, based on the trailers, had the sense that she'd be taking this really frenzied approach. The movie, and this is going to sound kind of esoteric, but the movie breathes in a way that no other film I've seen this year does. It has an enormous amount of patience. And I think there's almost a, certainly a boldness with which she took on this project.
Sure.
She's shooting at Versailles, not something a lot of people get access to. And you have to imagine the script, you know, a script made up of half overheard conversations.
Sure.
You can't imagine anybody has had a sense that this film would work based on the day-to-day shooting I feel like she had to have the cast had to have an enormous amount of trust in her, mm-hmm. because I can't imagine this film actually started to come to life until she got into the editing room.
No,
but I think it's brilliant.
That's a great point. I think that it's one of those cases where, sure, if you were the studio or one of the actors watching the dailies of this film, you probably would have been, what have we gotten ourselves into? Because it doesn't really probably feel like a movie until it was all assembled. And you're right, I thought of actually Robert Altman a little bit in Gosford Park, because the script here is almost non-existent. If you think about how many actual lines of dialogue there are, there's not much. It's about half. The screenplay has to be about half of what a normal screenplay is. And you're right, a lot of the scenes are overheard dialogue, characters just talking, the camera just capturing people mumbling almost, which is where, you know, I thought of Altman. And this film, I didn't have as strong a reaction to it as you did, and I thought you might love it. It has kind of your sense of humor about it, Sam. But it's funny with Coppola, none of her films, and I've liked The Virgin Suicides and Lost in Translation too, but because of that feeling of alienation and loneliness and isolation that I talked about, there's no real emotional core at the center of any of these films. They feel very dry in a way, or sterile, I think. And clearly that's something she's going for, but you walk out of them not really feeling as emotional maybe, or as moved as you might be. And so it's hard to feel like, wow, I really loved that film, or you have to go see Marie Antoinette. But I think that when it comes down to it, though, you know, this film is interesting because of that. I mean, I love the fact, I really respect that she's able to take a film and have characters never really at any point verbalize their emotions. If you think about it, you're waiting at any moment for Marie Antoinette, for Kirsten Dunst, to finally just say what she's feeling about something. She can't get her husband to sleep with her, and she's trying desperately to have sex with her husband, and he keeps rebuking her and keeps rolling over and whatever, and she never once just comes out and says, what is the deal? Why don't you find me attractive? Why, you know, why won't we have sex? She never says anything to him. You're waiting for her at some point to just have some kind of outburst of emotion. And there are a few moments where she's emotional, but have you ever seen a film? I can't think of one where a character never once, not a single character ever once, really actually says what's on their mind or what they're feeling about something, how something makes them feel. It's all very sterile in that way. But you know what? That for me is, again, kind of the excitement of it. It comes out of these characters, all just kind of their glances at the camera. And it comes down to this environment that she really creates. And I think it's the kind of thing where people, and we saw it in the theater I saw it with, people are going to be kind of surprised by this movie and very turned off by it. It is very deliberately paced. It's not at all like what the trailer suggests, which is this very pop, frenzied, as you said, revisionist take. I was expecting almost something like Tristram Shandy, which would be very anachronistic and having fun with comparing 18th century Paris, 18th century France to today. The movie's not really interested in any of that. It's very slow, and it does create these environments, and I think it's going to turn some people off, but like you, I was fascinated by it pretty much the entire time.
Yeah, I really was too, and I think she finds a really great way to, and she has an enormous respect for what Marie Antoinette was experiencing and what it was like to live in that time period. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The movie is absolutely revisionist by casting, I think kind of brilliantly, casting American actors with their American accents portraying these 18th century characters. It makes just as much sense, really, mm-hmm. for them to have what we'd be accustomed to. It's like, whether they're American or English actors speaking in an English accent, these are French people. Okay, let's just accept
right.
the artifice of it.
Yeah.
But I love the fact that, yes, it's anachronistic. It does have certainly an anachronistic
quality.
Well,
with the music.
The
sure.
music.
But the characters themselves don't ever behave as if they're not in this world.
Right. And that's what I liked about it, is that it became relevant. It allowed a relevancy that I think that I appreciated this time period. We've seen how many costume dramas have we seen?
Sure.
That may be absolutely pitch perfect accurate for the time period, but I can't actually relate. I can I know what they're experiencing maybe emotionally, mm-hmm. generally, but I can't actually get a sense for what it was like to live in that time period.
Right.
And by just reducing it to a language that we completely relate to, you know, just the casting and just the way, you know, and it's not that it's, she doesn't seem to be suggesting, oh, Marie Antoinette is way ahead of her time or a modern
no.
creature. She's just a girl, like you said, experiencing a sense of alienation in a strange place. And she does that. She brings me right into it.
Yeah,
again,
you're right.
With her patience of the camera, the way her dialogue works, or the lack of dialogue,
exactly.
the way she just observes them. In fact, I think she uses Kirsten Dunst and all her actors so well. I think it's just perfectly
mm-hmm.
cast. And the only times that it almost shatters the illusion is when Kirsten Dunst opens her mouth.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like I'd rather she never spoke a word in a way.
And she almost doesn't.
And she almost doesn't need to. And it's totally, totally effective.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I love the fact that watching this film, you really have no sense of history at all. Mm-hmm. These characters are basically ahistorical. And when you get to the end of the film, we argued over the epilogue or lack thereof of certain text at the end of The Last King of Scotland. There's no such epilogue here. We don't get Marie Antoinette was then beheaded and whatever. The movie just isn't remotely interested in that. And that makes sense because the fact is these characters, the reason they were brought down even is because trapped in their palace in Versailles, they have absolutely no sense of the outside world. And that's what's so hilarious then about those scenes where they're talking about the American Revolution and they're suggesting, you know, we need to help them and we're going to send soldiers over. You're asking
a
person,
commentary on the Bush administration.
Maybe so. But, you know, but it never felt too heavy-handed.
No.
But you're watching that scene and you're thinking, how can Louis XVI have any sense of what is right or what is wrong to do here in this situation? He has no political, you know, savvy whatsoever. He doesn't even know what's going on in the world, and she doesn't either. It almost becomes, you know, how can she know what the people of France are really going through and how they're suffering when all she knows is this isolated world? And so I thought that was really interesting. And like you, I love the artificiality of it where, you know, the pop songs that we certainly hear in the trailer, they kind of add to that artificiality. They take it out of history, certainly, and it becomes relevant in a way. And, you know, it makes it anachronistic, but that whole thing where the concept of celebrity comes up even a little bit, where the tabloids, where she's not going to read what's in the press about her, you know, that, of course, is a nice little touch, a little commentary about today as well. But it all works because it's kind of about this idea where people, again, are imposing their idea of who someone is. You know, rather than they have no idea who Marie Antoinette is. There's no way they could know because they've never even seen her, you know, for real. They only know pictures and what's written about her. That, of course, is all stuff that is really, I think, relevant today. And I think even what's great that she does is the way you, again, you have to take it out of history and into this artificial context. The beauty of the scene where she first arrives in France and they say, this is all symbolic. You're going to walk across this line from Austrian soil to French soil, and you'll be French all of a sudden. Just that concept of it, like she has to go across this line and completely shed who she is, I thought was really fascinating.
I do too. And I think, you know, I was waiting for Coppola to justify Marie Antoinette's narcissism or her betrayal. Mm-hmm. And you never do. She doesn't tell me as a viewer how I'm supposed to feel about her. By the end of it, all she's done is really humanize Marie Antoinette,
yeah.
I think completely successfully. And that's what made it so engaging to watch. And I was thinking too of, you know, our film spotting film school. You know, what films should you see? And I brought up Herzog.
Yeah.
I thought of Herzog a lot in this
film.
Only because, and very specifically, you described that scene, that sort of ceremonial scene. And the first time we're introduced to Jason Schwartzman, the future King Louis XVI, you know, he's with his buddies and talking about, like, I heard she's hot. I've heard Marie Antoinette is hot. And then he's like, okay, follow me. And he kind of trips over a branch.
Right.
And I was thinking of Kinski, you know, sort of tripping over a branch, you know, just walking around. The way that he captures that, the way that Herzog was able to capture that sense of people living in real time,
mm-hmm.
Coppola is just as successful as that. And there are wonderful scenes of beautiful absurdity, I think, Marie Antoinette's first daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Marie Antoinette, her husband, American English speakers. The daughter speaks with a French accent.
Uh-huh.
I was blown away by that.
Really?
I thought it was beautiful. Just a beautiful just gesture of, again, that artificiality of artifice. And you mentioned earlier that you didn't think, and I agree with you with Virgin Suicides and with Lost in Translation, there is a sense of emotional lethargy.
Yeah,
that,
sterility. I mean,
agreed. I think this film actually has a lot more soul to it in some way, where I could identify with the pain of Marie Antoinette living in this, like, living the same day, day in, day out. And the way she was able to capture that sense of routine, of dull, absurd routine.
Yeah.
But also, I loved that she was able to capture that sense of time passing early in the carriage.
Yeah.
Blowing on the window and then, like, carving her name
in
the
fog.
It's a
lovely girlish moment, too.
It's a girlish moment where you feel like, and I think Coppola has been able to make very personal films without ever being indulgent.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think some people could label this film as self-indulgent. I'm sure some people have. I'm not willing to accuse the movie of that either. And, you know, another movie I thought about was actually the movie we just reviewed on our show, Little Children. You think about the whole scene where Kate Winslet is talking about Madame Bovary and this revisionist take sort of on Madame Bovary as the feminist, as kind of the first feminist or whatever, because she, despite all her struggles and all the bad decisions she makes, she's always struggling. She makes the decision to hunger and to struggle for happiness. And I think clearly that that is what she's doing here, even though I agree with you that on the whole, what is good about the film and effective is that she doesn't seem to be really hitting us over the head with it, where it's like, okay, Marie Antoinette was really a hero. You're right. She's not trying to do that. And she makes us empathize with her much more than makes us sympathize with her. I think that is definitely the case. And I think it is a bold move on her part to even suggest this idea that Marie Antoinette could have been seen as a feminist in kind of those same ways that, as I said, Kate Winslet describes Madame Bovary. So I thought that was interesting. And I just want to briefly mention, too, the visual kind of strategy at work here, because you talked about it with that scene, the great scene of where we meet Jason Schwartzman for the first time. And I think it's really interesting how Coppola uses a lot of long shots in this movie, and the characters are a lot of times framed directly in the center of the frame, and they all seem really small. And then she only uses close-ups at certain times, usually in moments of kind of heightened emotion, the rare ones that we get with Kirsten Dunst breaking into tears or with her, you know, having sex with the Swedish soldier. You know, those kind of moments. So that's really effective, but these characters all seem really dwarfed by their surroundings, which I think is really interesting because they are, of course, in a way, they're really trapped and confined by where they are, and they feel really insignificant and feel really small inside the Palace of Versailles. I thought that was interesting. So I'm with you. I didn't maybe have that real emotional kick to it that it seemed to have for you, but I certainly respected her position or understood what I think Coppola was trying to say about Marie Antoinette, and I felt for her without a doubt. And I guess that alone is enough to recommend the movie, because Marie Antoinette, let's face it, is one of the most probably reviled characters in history, and the fact that we get a new take on that was interesting.
Absolutely, and I do. I think it's fair to say that Sofia Coppola is among the most exciting young directors working today. We just talked about our directors of the future. With this film, yeah, she immediately enters my top five. What's she doing next? I want to know.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to quickly acknowledge the fact how many emails we'll get from people who watch this movie and go, what are you guys talking about?
I can't
this
wait.
Movie is dull and boring and
I think,
slow.
You mentioned deliberate, and I think we try to warn people of that, because I use words like exciting, and it is for me. It's full of surprise,
right,
of emotional surprise and revelation. But you're right. Deliberate is the right word for this, especially we can absolutely say that the trailers are misleading in that sense.
Yeah.
I do. I think it's a real treat for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I'll just close out, too, by saying that I mentioned to my friend BRK, I saw it with a friend of mine, and I said to him afterwards that, you know what, if you can't relate to this character at all, like whether you're a guy, how old you are, doesn't matter, if you can't find any room for empathy with what Marie Antoinette is going through, then you are really going to hate this film. But I think we both were able to empathize with her and identify with her. So,
all right. Well, if you've seen Marie Antoinette and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave us a message.
When we come back, Sam Van Hallgren, protector of women, promoter of racial harmony, sadist? We'll find out next in listener feedback. Stay with us. You say you know what's in store. Why don't you keep it to yourself? If this is what you know, why don't you keep it on your shelf? Don't tell me that it's over. Been hearing that for oh so long. Who needs a DJ?
Hey guys, Mark in Atlanta. Just got done listening to your show and your top five about top five movies of Starting Over, and I can't believe you guys missed out on Office Space. This seems like a glaring omission, like Empire Strikes Back not being on both your top five twist endings.
Welcome back to Film Spotting, and that was our friend Mark in Atlanta leaving us a voicemail, Sam, suggesting how could we leave off Office Space, a movie about starting over,
sure.
And certainly he's right, in a movie I know I love.
And I love it too. I really like it a lot. And starting over, it's true. I mean, you couldn't start over in a more kind of lethargic way. I feel like that's the word of the day a little bit,
it
but
is
it's
the word
like
of the day.
By not starting over in a way,
yeah.
By not doing,
yeah. But certainly one
because I think it did occur to me, but I'm just like it's not very active.
That's true,
but it's certainly appropriate
and one that I know we probably both considered for our list, but couldn't crack the top five. Let's get to the Pierflix DVD giveaway winner. Of course, we're giving away Reservoir Dogs, the 15th anniversary edition, and this week's PureFlix winner is Rick Muraghi from L.A., Los Angeles, California. Congratulations, Rick. Look for your copy of Reservoir Dogs soon, courtesy of PureFlix.
That's right, and sign up at PureFlix.com/filmspotting by Friday at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, mark your calendars, to be entered to win the 60th anniversary edition of It's a Wonderful Life. Also out this week, Mission Impossible 3.
Sam?
Which we both liked. I'm sticking by it.
Wasn't it one of your top five of the year?
I think it was early in June.
Maybe.
Yeah. I think it just is now out of my top
out
10
of the, top
of the year.
Five.
I've
out
actually
of the top
seen
10.
Enough legitimate films. And I wonder how. Is it just that I don't want Mission Impossible? I don't want to have to defend it at the end
yes.
of the year. I honestly liked
I know you did.
Mission Impossible 3.
I know,
a
and
lot.
I liked it too. Not quite as much as you, but that's exactly it. You just do not want to defend it.
I just don't
it,
want to have to defend it.
And I don't blame you.
I hope enough people saw it and liked it, but I'm not going to defend it at the end of the year. It's going to have to, you know, sink or swim on its own.
Uh huh.
Also, keeping up with the Steins and The Departed's Vera Farmiga. I'm not sure we got to talk about her too much
in
our Departed review, but she's very good.
She is
very
good.
Interesting. She stars in this new film, Down to the Bone, which looks interesting.
Out on DVD, yes.
On
I
DVD,
don't know anything
right.
about that film, though, so something we'll have to look into. Donations this week, Sam, we need to thank the people who, as always, have been so generous as to go to filmspotting.net and throw a few bucks our way. We want to single out some of the donors here, Sam. Take it away.
All right. We've got Kevin, lower back bullseye, or Captain Bullseye. He can take his pick. Then we've got another Kevin here, Kevin P. Kevin P. with Magic Underoos. I'm going with.
Okay.
Or, yeah.
Uninspired,
again, this is a little uninspired, but I was going off of his last name as a cue, which
yeah.
I try to do.
Yeah.
Which, can you see
a
where I'm going there?
Spider-Man reference.
All right. Fair
yeah.
enough. I couldn't make that work, though. I didn't turn the corner on that. There's usually, you know, there's
yeah.
usually some other element to the nickname.
Okay, well, let's see if you can redeem yourself with the last one.
Okay, I think I did. Michael, empathy for Stalin. I went with that.
Okay.
So, again,
nice.
None of these nicknames are ones people would self-apply to themselves.
No, they
I don't
not.
Think, but, Magic Underoos, I'm going to work on that. By the time this is posted, along with the rest of when we're going to post the nicknames of this week's donors
on our site.
On the site, Kevin P., I will have modified your nickname to reflect
okay.
something a bit more.
There you go. So, yes, if you want to see the list of people who have donated with your nickname.
I went with the last of the Underoos first, but it
okay.
didn't. Underoos are something people wear.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, well, you can look at the show notes for this show on filmspotting.net and find that list.
Yeah.
So again, thank you to everyone. We also want to thank Frank in Brisbane, Australia, who is the proprietor, I guess you could call him,
well,
of
crackspotting.com,
the fan site that is fun to check out from time to time. And Frank was the person, he was the winner of the Todd Field button contest. If you go to our site right now, filmspotting.net,
all our graphic designing
all the
listeners.
Graphic design listeners, we appreciate everybody who sent in a submission, but Frank sent us like six or seven different ones, and one of them we really liked the best, even though we argued about
it. We did argue about
it. And of course we did, and that image is at the top right of our page. If
there
you
should be
go,
like a second feed where we just have like our petty arguments
that would be
off
great.
The mic.
Yeah.
That's a good time.
that's a whole separate show.
That is a separate
Film
show.
Film spotting the petty arguments.
Yeah.
And you can go if you want and listen to the entire Todd Field interview, which you heard in Saturday's show, the BEZ show, was about a 14-minute cut of the interview. The whole interview was actually around 26 minutes long.
Yeah.
If you want to go listen to the whole thing, go to filmspotting.net. And also at filmspotting.net, you can participate in our poll question. Sam, let's first start with last week's poll question.
Right.
We're asking about Borat.
Borat, yeah. We asked you, Borat will be the funniest movie of the year, the funniest movie of the last 5 years, a disappointment, or not worth my time. Coming in at 54%, the funniest movie of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked you, I was like, what's the competition here?
I don't know.
We saw Accepted. We disagreed. Talladega Nights, good point. Okay,
Little Miss Sunshine.
Clerks 2, Little Miss Sunshine, the sour vision of Little Miss Sunshine. Sure. So right now, 54% of you,
yeah.
among those many lovers of Little Miss Sunshine, among others,
true.
Are calling Borat, yet unseen, the
right.
funniest
but
movie
But they're
of
saying
the year.
It will be the funniest
That's right.
movie.
17%, actually a tie here, 17% said it's going to be the funniest movie of the last 5 years, 17% said not worth my time, and then 11% a disappointment, which could just mean, look, the trailer is the funniest trailer all year.
Yes.
I've seen it dozens of times.
Right.
I, you know, some people watch it daily.
Yeah,
a
no,
ritual.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Can it live up to the trailer?
Right, because actually one person wrote in a comment to the poll question and said, where's the middle ground? Well, in a way, a disappointment's the middle ground, because you're basically saying, it's not necessarily saying that the movie won't be funny, but that it just can't quite live up to being the funniest of the year or the funniest the last 5 years. So
we desire it to be.
We'll see. Okay, we have a little more business poll question this time actually.
Right,
Something, some housekeeping, some market research, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
We're curious, and we'll get into the reasons maybe behind this on a later show, but we're really just curious, so we're asking a question about us this time. We don't often do this in the poll question, but we want to know quite simply.
Do you like us?
Do you like
us?
No,
it's not true.
Assuming no show was more than an hour, more than 60 minutes, how often would you ideally like to hear Film Spotting?
Your choice is weekly is just fine, back to two shows a week, or the more, the better. Be careful what you ask for, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go to filmspotting.net. This may be one of the most important poll questions ever.
Ever.
You are dictating the content, the future of Film Spotting, perhaps.
And 3 months do not pass before we give you a chance to modify the complete format
again
of Film Spotting.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
We don't want to get rusty here.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, please go to filmspotting.net and vote in that poll question. Sam, let's get into the mailbag now. And actually, we just want to briefly mention that we have had some prestige feedback rolling in, but not enough yet that we really want to get into it. So let's wait. We're going to have some more prestige feedback next week on the show. If you've seen it, want to chime in, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Yes, so we'll be getting to that. I think it's the show that will post on the 8th of November.
I believe so.
If my math is correct.
Yes, Wednesday, November 8th, we'll get into that. Let's talk about Sam, one of our great arguments, one of our truly great disagreements.
Although it's interesting, listening back to the show that Last King of Scotland, our Last King of Scotland discussion debuted on, that we agreed for like 10 minutes.
I know.
I think because we set it up, we're like, man, it is just a head-to-head, you know, battle royale. Get ready for it. And then you listen to the first 10 minutes of the show.
We're
like,
agreement.
Yeah, it's really good, really good. I really
like
that.
But then, Sam, you take a turn.
Yeah.
You take a turn for the worse, and it becomes a full-blown fight. And we had some people
running to your defense without even seeing the film.
It's great. I haven't had really any people support me who have seen it yet.
No.
But we did get some people who are supporting me nevertheless, and we are going to give them some time right now on Film Spotting. So why don't you go ahead and start with Jeremy Meyer, my friend Jeremy Meyer.
All right. Jeremy Meyer from Haverford, PA writes, I haven't seen the film yet. I want that to be on the record.
Uh-huh.
But I can still take issue with one of Sam's criticisms of the film. Sam faults the film for not talking about what happened to Uganda after Idi Amin left power at the end of the film, citing, yes, Idi Amin just walked off the screen at the end of the film. He didn't actually leave power.
Uh-huh.
He just left the film. Left power at the end of the film, citing that as evidence that the filmmaker doesn't care about the country. I think it would have been a huge mistake for Last King of Scotland or any film to deal with that issue in just a brief epilogue. Maybe Sam thinks that Uganda is a basket case because of the legacy of Amin, and in some ways it is, but the real picture is actually quite complex, and Jeremy goes on to explain really the last...
How complex it is.
Just how complex it is and has been over the past 30 years. And then he ends, as this long-winded email suggests, there really is no way to briefly sum up the post-Amin tale of Uganda without ignoring or grossly oversimplifying major events in Ugandan history. But bringing them up would also lead the viewer into tangents that have little to do with the events of the Amin era that is the focus of the film. Rather than indicating a lack of concern about Uganda, the fact that the filmmaker didn't provide a pat, simplified version of post-Ugandan history as an epilogue to The Last King of Scotland can be seen as more respectful of the country, not less.
Booyah! Jeremy just nailed you right between the eyes. There's absolutely no way you can respond to that.
Yes,
there
is.
Dead.
I'm going to try.
He's absolutely
right.
No,
he's not.
And I basically said that, just not as well as he said it during my review.
I disagree, and I still stand by my opinion that McDonald doesn't actually have any real interest in Uganda other than as the site of this monster, and so his lead character, this Scottish lad, can escape from the monster.
Okay.
I don't think he really has any sympathy or curiosity about the land itself. When I said, you know what, at the end of the film, we have an epilogue that tells us what happened to Idi Amin.
Briefly,
he went in exile in Saudi Arabia, died in 2003.
Yeah.
And it brought home to me that he didn't seem to care what happened to Uganda afterwards.
Okay.
And for me, I'm just like, why not just have an epilogue? This is something that Jeremy wrote in that says, Amin was, after leaving power, Amin was succeeded by Milton Obote, the same dictator he overthrew to get into power.
Yeah, that would have changed everything.
I'm not saying it would have changed everything, but it would have said, like, this is what happened to Uganda. This is what happened to the political regime. It returned to the same
sense. It would have been
not.
It would have been much more disrespectful, patronizing to try to sum up 30 years of complex.
It's not a matter of summing up. I'm just saying it respected the fact that Ugandan history had to continue. All it cared about was this sort of like, and I think kind of like a cute kind of the way the film ends with. What imagining, you know, or just telling us about Amin, he died in 2003, and then gets back to this whole idea that Amin had envisioned his death.
Sure.
So he was invincible, he was invulnerable because he knew when he was going to die.
Right.
And it ends on, you know, the film ends with like, nobody knows.
Yeah.
That's kind of ridiculous, I think.
No.
And I think it just, for me, the end of the film solidified for me my suspicions all along that MacDonald really didn't have a lot of interest or insight into the country that it could have. It doesn't change the film.
That isn't what the story is. And we
I
can
think
argue
he has a responsibility to that. Yes.
He totally met whatever responsibility he had to the story that he is telling. And again, if you wanted an entire documentary,
totally
as
I
our
don't
listener
need
suggests,
a documentary.
Apparently you did. John Jackson here writes in and he says, wait, Sam, you just said that you didn't like the Constant Gardener's liberal agenda, but you want to see a documentary, essentially, at the end of The Last King of Scotland. Okay, then. What
How
would you
are
get?
A few lines, one line, about what happened to Uganda after Amin left
imagine
power?
Imagine that, John using hyperbole. I don't know anyone else who does that to make a point here on this
only
show.
Only every show.
But he says, if after being lulled and charmed by Whitaker, you didn't have a palpable sense of distress as all Asians were shipped out of the country at the dismembered corpse, then I would say you have no soul. If as
see the monster,
the case,
make the Asians flee from Uganda,
that you
great.
Want to see even more carnage, a countrywide Holocaust, then
yeah,
you, I would
I
say
see.
That it is impossible
I
and hope
bring it.
That being so obviously
bring
a sadist,
McDonald.
You would
maybe
see
it's in the outtakes. I hope so.
Attention.
I don't care. Look,
I don't know what John just said because you were talking over it, but
doesn't
the fact
matter.
Is, you completely missed the boat on this film.
No,
you completely missed it.
No,
because you're actually criticizing for not being what you want it to be when there could be 10 or 20 different films
the
made
film
about
Idi
Amin in
Uganda. Have any sense of complexity. It didn't want to take a complex issue
still,
and delve into
and
it.
And that's still ridiculous.
It's a very simple film.
It is a simple tale, actually.
Simple tale.
A simple tale with a lot of complex things going on. And the only
and
way that you see
know how
it
to
as
get into
totally
this.
Simple and not and shallow
right.
is if you in no way relate to the main character, which
that's
is ultimately
not true.
Your
totally
big
relate
problem,
to the character. I told you I liked the way they portrayed that
no,
character.
You think you're better than him.
No, I don't. You said, I admitted to you that it's not his unlikability. He is flawed. That is a better
he's
way to put it.
He's too flawed for you, Sam.
No, he's not. He's exactly perfectly flawed to fulfill the needs of that movie.
His plight
which ultimately becomes boring.
You
me.
Didn't see his dilemma as complex, apparently. And it's very
no,
complex.
No, it's not complex.
Yeah, it
no, it's not.
Okay,
he's
well,
a little brat, and he goes to Uganda, and then he leaves.
Wow.
Big deal.
Unbelievable. He's so wrong, ladies and gentlemen.
But
okay.
I did like the film. I think it's all
yeah,
right.
Yeah, nice. Nice
Forrest
try.
Whitaker is very good.
And we didn't even get into how you completely contradicted your whole Constant Gardener take.
I'm going to get
no, we're
briefly.
Not. No, we're not. You can write
that
about,
was confusing.
Sam, you can write about it in the dope sheet. We're moving on.
Fine.
I'm sorry. I'm putting down the
I
hammer.
I don't really like the Constant Gardener.
I know you don't.
I do
but
like how the director depicts
no.
Okay.
The
people.
Another voicemail.
Africa.
Another voicemail. We're moving on. Audio feedback. Another message
I totally
about
schooled you and all your
oh
listeners.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm really feeling it. We have a voicemail here. Paul in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. He wants to chime in on a recent top five movies about starting over.
Hello, this is Paul Daniela calling from Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Regarding your top five lists of last week, Redemption, a movie that you might have missed and should consider is The Verdict, 1982, Paul Newman, Sidney Lumet, David Mamet script. How you overlooked this, I don't know. How you overlooked it even for top five 80s movies is beyond me, but the acting is superb.
So Paul wants to discuss The Verdict,
The Verdict
Sam. He says maybe even one of the best movies from the 80s, a movie that should have been saved from the incinerator, the ash heap of history that we had on a recent top five. But actually, we've talked about
Newman
The Verdict
great, we have.
Briefly on the show before. Mamet wrote the script.
Movies about drunks, I think,
maybe.
And drinking.
Yeah, it
yep.
could be. You've got Mamet wrote the script. You've got Paul Newman, who's fantastic in it. You know, there's a lot of good things about The Verdict. But as I've said on the show before, and I'm not a lawyer, but you know what? The end of the movie, I find the courtroom scene so preposterous at the end of The Verdict that it completely ruins the entire movie for me, actually, when I get to the end of it. So for me, The Verdict is a decent film, again, a great performance by Newman, and some other great performances by some of the supporting
Lindsay
people.
Krause, yeah, I think.
Lindsay Krause is in it, and also I'm forgetting the great
James Mason.
James Mason, but the French actress, too, who everyone talks about how she's still very attractive today.
Yes.
Because she was in Swimming Pool, I think, and I'm just completely drawing a blank. We'll put it in the notes to the show, but
yes.
Anyway, She's in it. They're all very good. And yet, on the whole, the verdict for me is
I like it.
I
think it's one of my favorite Mamet scripted films, actually.
Okay.
I do.
Great. Well, we have another one here, Sam. A top five. Why don't you take it from Ivar?
Yes, Ivar in
Stavanger, Norway?
Stavanger, Norway.
Okay.
His top five. Movies about starting over. He's got Casablanca. Cynical Bogart changes his view on life after meeting Ingrid Bergman again. Number four, The Shawshank Redemption. Number three, The Grifters. Angelica Houston's character tries to start over but must sacrifice more than most people would sacrifice. Number two, Vertigo. And number one, film spotting favorite, The Sweet Hereafter. The film shows how a group of people try to start over their lives after their children have died. Heartbreaking and cinema at its finest.
Not going to get an argument here, film that is a favorite of ours and has been featured in a lot of top five. So thank you for that. Ivar and Sam, let's just do one more here before we go to the break, and we'll get into a little bit more later in the show. We've got this one from Rob Skelly in Derby, England. His top five, The Bourne Identity. Number four, that was on our list, I believe, both of us.
Both of our lists.
Number four for Rob, Jean de Florette, Frenchman leaves Paris to start a new life in the country. Number three, The Motorcycle Diaries, Che Guevara leaves medical school to find himself and his people, a movie I considered. Number two, another movie I considered, Some Like It Hot, Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis start over with brand new wardrobes. And actually, you know, Rob wants to know how come he's never heard us mention this film. I just left it out of a recent top five. And what top five would it be? Because I considered it for starting over, but Deception, that's it.
Yeah.
Our top five movies about Deception, literally it was almost number six. So I almost considered
forced
it.
Forced to deceive, forced to start over by outside forces.
There you
case.
Go.
Yeah.
And number one, Shirley Valentine, a film I'm not familiar with. Low budget, but the ultimate let's just chuck it all in and do something less boring instead movie. I think Pauline Collins was nominated for a Best Actress Oscar for playing the lead. So thank you for that, Rob. And again, we've got some more great listener feedback on movies about starting over. We'll get to it right before the top five later in the show.
That's right. And if you've got feedback for us, send an email to feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail. Call 206-203-2463 and leave a message or send us an MP3 clip.
After the break, we wrap up the documentaries marathon with Robert Epstein's The Times of Harvey Milk and offer up some truly terrifying acting in massacre theater. Stay with us.
Four cheers for the underground. Thought a beer and a sunset could make you stay. Make way for the thunder clouds. Gonna pummel the sea. And the sky is a bruise, it's about to be rain. And no one told me about you.
Did you have a fight?
No.
Is Father loading up the shotgun?
What? Please, stop it.
It's happened before, you know. Some of the world's happiest marriages have started under the gun, as you might say.
No, she's just not the girl for me.
Yeah, she's only perfect.
She's too perfect. She's too talented. She's too beautiful. She's too sophisticated. She's too everything but what I want.
Is what you want something you can discuss?
Welcome back. It's time for Massacre Theater. Last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard from Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window with Jimmy Stewart and Thelma Ritter, a tie-in with last week's top five movies about Deception.
That is right. And I actually had two Hitchcock movies in my top five.
That's right.
So maybe it threw some people off that we had another Hitchcock movie in there, but it was Rear Window. And because we're recording this segment, actually, Sam, before the Rear Window Massacre Theater aired, it's all very confusing, believe me, for us too.
The universe is holding in on all our listeners and myself.
Check the notes for this show on filmspotting.net to see if you're the winner. So if you're listening to this show right now, go to filmspotting.net, look at the notes.
Maybe you're the winner.
You might be the winner.
No, no, Miss Lamont, round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
All right, time for this week's scene. And Sam, it simply ties in with our top five scary movie moments. So think of
frightening,
scary
terrifying
movies, frightening,
movie
terrifying stuff. And I start it, so you're going to give me the action.
And action.
They nailed it shut.
Good. I don't like sellers. Probably just some garbage down there anyways.
You know she's a woman, right, Sam? Do you want to maybe try that again?
I had a lot to drink last night. This is how I talk.
Yeah. You want to try it again?
You're right.
I'm giving you another shot. Okay.
And action.
They nailed it shut.
Good. I don't like cellars. Probably just some garbage down there anyways.
They don't nail garbage in cellars. I mean, it's not going to try and get out or anything.
Well, what's down there?
Well, could be any number of things. Old baseball cards, mushrooms, dead bodies.
And scene.
Much better, Sam.
In character.
Much better in character. Thank you very much for indulging me.
I'm sorry for trying to mislead anybody listening with my male rendering of that scene.
I think it would have been very misleading. So I needed you to play off of,
you're
Sam.
Right. You're right.
To be real.
I know.
Okay. Well, if you know what film Sam and I just massacred, send us an email by Monday, November 6th to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Wednesday's show.
2 days after I was elected, I got a phone call. The voice was quite young. It was from Altoona, Pennsylvania. And the person said, "Thanks. And you've got to elect gay people so that that young child and the thousands upon thousands like that child know that there's hope for a better world."
All right, we are here at the end of our six-week documentaries marathon, heading into our conversation of The Times of Harvey Milk, directed by Robert Epstein. And I was thinking about the six films that make up our marathon, and they seem to fall into three pretty neat categories. You've got D.A. Pennybaker's Don't Look Back and Barbara Kopple's Harlan County, USA. Both take interesting subjects whose stories are unfolding right in front of the cameras. Pennybaker and Kopple might have had, you know, their own prejudices and sympathies, certainly, for their subjects, but they could not really have known in any way how their film would end up. Then we have the two Errol Morris films, Gates of Heaven and Vernon, Florida, which really probably are better termed philosophical inquiries, really, than traditional documentaries. Mm-hmm. Their themes and their tone are really more important than the subject matter, or equally important, I should probably say. And then we have Peter Davis's Hearts and Minds, and now Robert Epstein's The Times of Harvey Milk, which I think could be fairly called activist documentaries in some way. Both films look back at a time or a person or an event and attempt to offer some kind of perspective. Davis admitted to a very specific goal with Hearts and Minds, to find out why we went to Vietnam, what we did when we went there, and what the going to Vietnam did to us. And we agreed. We didn't really care for Hearts and Minds all that much. We thought that Davis's, you know, vehemently anti-Vietnam War agenda resulted in a kind of exploitation of the subjects of his film. Now with Harvey Milk, we have, in this case, really America's first openly gay elected official, assassinated in 1978. And the film is interestingly called, I think, The Times of Harvey Milk, mm-hmm. not Harvey Milk, the first openly gay elected official.
Right.
And I think that's partly a way to offer some sort of insight in terms of how they approach this documentary.
Sure.
How did you compare it maybe specifically to Hearts and Minds?
Well, I think that is a good comparison. There is a comparison there to make. It's certainly activist. They turn Harvey Milk, let's face it, into a martyr, and I think that maybe a flaw of the film even is that they don't ever get the perspective of someone who doesn't like Harvey Milk. And surely there had to be someone out there other than just someone who is
other than the man who shot him.
Other than the man who shot him, or other than someone who's blatantly homophobic.
Right.
They never get anybody who suggests, you know what, maybe he wasn't a great city councilman. You know what, I was a political rival of his, you know, and there were things about him that I didn't like. And
there were a few opportunities where people offered some criticism of him where it's like, you know, he would get very upset and emotional.
Yeah, I mean, but
again,
that's like one of his closest confidants saying that he was a guy who could kind of occasionally get temperamental.
Right.
Really,
that's
it's
about
not,
all they offered,
it's not ultimately a criticism of him, and certainly there could have been people who were critical of him. I think even that they downplayed Dan White, the guy who ultimately, the city councilman who goes and kills him and kills George Moscone, the mayor of San Francisco, at the same time, basically, that they even kind of downplay their relationship as being rivals. They point out in one case that Proposition 6, this big proposition that a senator of California is trying to push through that would require all gay teachers to come
be fired,
out,
essentially.
Be fired, basically,
yeah.
If they're openly
Briggs,
gay.
Yeah.
Jim Briggs, I think, is his name. And it's interesting because they suggest that Dan White actually opposed Proposition 6. And yet I've read some things about it that say that, you know, he really was kind of, they weren't just people who were, you know, Harvey Milk is your typical what we would call now blue state and Dan White's a good old-fashioned red stater, but that he was kind of anti-gay and there were real tensions between them. And the movie, I think, almost downplays the tension between them in order to make the shock of what he does later even more surprising. But, you know, the criticism that we had of Hearts and Minds, basically that it was too sprawling, and by being too sprawling, he ends up kind of not getting at the most interesting characters and the most interesting storylines, and of course, this movie gets it right by being more focused. They try to tackle something very big, the times of Harvey Milk. It's not the life and times, it's the times of Harvey Milk, as you talked about with the title, and they get it right by focusing on Harvey Milk, and the larger themes then of the issues that he was exploring and the issues raised by his death and everything that happened after that. Those come out of, and we suggested that Peter Davis could have done the same thing. You could have explored a lot more interesting themes by focusing on a few more characters and exploring themes rather than giving us a bunch of snapshots.
And get their full perspective as opposed to, you know, isolating their perspective 2 feet his ends.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think Harvey Milk, very similar, but gets it right, does what exactly Hearts and Minds didn't do. And you know, I have to say, too, that, you know, the most fascinating stuff about the movie, about this movie, wasn't the biography. Wasn't the stuff about Harvey Milk, but the snapshots of this time period, the move to the religious right. It's really interesting that when Harvey Milk takes office, everything seems kind of open and liberal. And I know this is San Francisco, but, you know, times were changing and everyone's kind of, oh, we've got Harvey Milk in office and everything's cool. And he's passing gay rights laws and all this stuff. And then all of a sudden, guys like Jim Briggs and these preachers show up and we start to see the growth of the moral majority. You want to talk about relevance today, that red state, blue state divide, it's here in San Francisco in the late 70s. And like I said, Proposition 6, the tie-in with Jonestown even, the fact that the assassination came right on the heels of Jonestown, which rocked San Francisco because most of those people...
Yeah, really the day after,
right,
amazing
were from there. And just, you know, the chaos of San Francisco, the injustice of the court decision. You know, we all know about the Twinkie defense. All of these things that came out of Harvey Milk and his story that the movie brings up, you know, I thought really... an important film. This is an emotional film. And, you know, it's one of those films, too, that I've been telling a lot of people about. People that aren't even, you know, into film, really, or into documentaries. You know, we've seen a lot of great films in this documentary. I may even like one or two others of them better or say they're more important. But I've been telling people just at work. I'm like, do you know about Harvey Milk?
That's it.
This
yeah.
is this amazing story.
Discovery.
I mean,
yeah.
because for me, it was. Yes, I knew who Harvey Milk was. Yes, I knew about the Twinkie defense, whatever. But I didn't know all that other stuff that happened around them. And that, to me, was really fascinating. When you tell people about it, about Dan White and how he got let off because of voluntary manslaughter and what happened in San Francisco. I mean, some of the shots in this film of the candlelight vigil and just really powerful, amazing stuff. And like I said, I've been telling a lot of people about it. So obviously it worked for me.
Yeah, it worked for me, too. And yeah, you bring up this point about Harvey Milk. It's like, yes, we're introduced to him, and yes, he's treated as a martyr, which in some ways he saw himself as. I mean, he really sort of foresaw his own death.
He knew he was going to die.
He knew he was going to die, and he was willing to die for the cause. We're not, you know, the movie doesn't criticize that notion at all. You know, was that part of his, you know, ultimate agenda, maybe? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it is, but, you know, his willingness to put himself out there for his cause is equally admirable and almost questionable in terms of, like, what's his... You know, what does he really hope to achieve personally versus politically? And mm-hmm. whatever. But the movie isn't really interested in that. And there's almost a sense that he's has an enigmatic quality. We don't really, like you said, we don't really get to know Harvey Milk. We know sort of where he comes from, coming from the East Coast, and how he arrived, and various and such. But I mean, really, the more heroic character, in a way, almost could be, and I feel like they introduced this notion of Mayor Moscone. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, the only reason Harvey Milk became elected was that he allowed the neighborhoods in the city were finally allowed to elect their
choose
representatives
their, yeah.
as opposed to it being citywide elections. And but the movie doesn't quite follow up on that either. But again, I came around to this notion. The movie is called The Times of Harvey Milk, and what we I think we have an amazing insight through archival footage and through interviews with these people that lived through the time of that time. And like you said, there was an absolute sense of discovery of that this happened and what this meant. And I agree. You brought up this whole idea of like the rise of the right, of the far right, the conservative right, the religious right, mm-hmm. and it's tragic in a way. I mean, you look at John Briggs or Jim Briggs, the way he framed this whole debate about Proposition 6 is so destructive because not only is it senseless, he was using the exact same language as Rick Santorum uses. Mm-hmm. to talk about the gay marriage debate. I mean, comparing homosexuality to bestiality. And I think part of the issue here you see is like, no, the proposition miraculously, and it's a worthy of celebration, did not pass. But you still, like, the dialogue has infected people's perception of a group of people. Mm-hmm. You know, you realize, like, yes, a proposition, you know, was not passed. That's cause for celebration. And yet they've brought up this idea of, you know, they've equated homosexuals with child molesters, mm-hmm. in the minds of families, of public. And you realize just, you know, how propositions aren't the only way to pollute the debate,
sure.
of this kind of thing. And how, you know, the deep sadness of being 30 years along and having this, you know, having the same notion
not change,
come up, not
really,
change at
in
all.
Many ways. Yeah, no, I agree.
But I think you're right, like, to bring up the points. I think it's a fairly conventionally told in,
yes.
terms of the talking heads and the archival footage, and we don't get serious insight into a lot of people, but it was the kind of things you mentioned. Just the sight of that vigil, mm-hmm. was just so powerful, so moving. And I think Milk's last speech, which we heard a piece of, coming into this discussion, I mean, it really offers you the kind of perspective. And yes, you know, if the movie has an agenda, but it's one that is clear, and it's about civil rights, and it really I think it gives you an insight into a time, a piece of history, but it also is totally and completely relevant.
Yeah, you know? It is. And I agree with you too about what you said about George Moscone. He becomes a really interesting character, and it's bad enough that Harvey Milk was killed, but then you realize too that this mayor, who really had a lot of foresight and yeah. was obviously a guy who was an older guy, I mean, in his 50s certainly at least, right. but was very tolerant and open and had these interesting ideas, and really politically he sounds like a fascinating guy, and you realize that he was another casualty,
yeah.
of this as well. So right. that makes it even tougher. So, you know, like I said, I really was by the end of it kind of spent emotionally. I really, you know, this film did speak to me. And I think that one of the interesting things too is what you were talking about in terms of that debate and kind of infiltrating people's perspectives on things, this kind of dialogue and this rhetoric. That's why one of the most interesting parts of the film is the guy who's like an electrician, as blue collar as you get, but someone who was kind of fed up with how things were going politically, and someone who admits that if he was ever around gay people, if he heard about even police going into
roughing
bars and
up, yeah.
beating up gay people, well, that's fine with him. Yeah. That's what you should do, yeah. or that's what people do. I mean,
right.
they're fruits. He talked about it in that way. But then he goes and he ends up listening to a speech of Harvey Milk, and he likes what he had to say. He realized that he wants to almost not like him, but every time he opens his mouth, he realizes that he agrees with him. And he ends up becoming a guy who's obviously a big supporter
converted
of him,
in
some
way,
and
yeah.
someone who is really offended by the opposition. And it hurt when he's killed, obviously.
Right.
I mean, that was really powerful, too. So, and I go back as well. I mean, the editing of the film, even though a lot of it early on is, you know, I think that's why for me, maybe this documentary feels not as important as maybe even something like Harlan County, just
right.
in that it's, you know, yes, we have talking heads and it feels kind of conventional, but the way,
and
for example,
it doesn't have an immediacy. Yeah.
Yeah. But you right. know, the immediacy does come at the end,
yes.
when the murders happen, you have this sense of immediacy, of urgency that they're
yep.
there, and the way that's all spliced together. I mean, you really do feel like you're there.
That's
and when
true.
You get to the actual, then the candlelight vigil, like I mentioned, that's just an amazing shot.
Yep.
And that whole sequence is really powerful. And you know, the police cars on fire and City Hall being broken into. I mean, that was all stuff that not only is interesting to look at in some way and causes a reaction, but it's just stuff, to go back to what I initially said, I just didn't know about.
Right.
I didn't know about what this kind of the injustice of this verdict back in the late 70s or
yeah,
whatever, caused.
Yeah.
I didn't know about those consequences and how people reacted to it, and that there was a riot in San Francisco. It's just, it opened up just a lot of stuff for me.
But so. I loved how the how Epstein treated that. I mean, he didn't entirely defend the violent outburst, but he also gave people an opportunity to speak their mind that I totally related to about why it justifies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, isn't it a violent act to let off a murderer? And equating that with, like, the response.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a, you know, a peaceful vigil on the murders, but the injustice is what causes the riots. And you sympathize with them, but to then, following that justification, you have somebody speaking. It's like, no, we need to step back. We can't be the ones that have
right.
a violent response. And I thought it was really – I thought they handled that really well, of offering different perspectives
mm-hmm.
on – you know, and so it, you can elaborate that on a number of civil rights struggles. So,
sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, obviously, we closed out the marathon
yeah,
on a strong note here.
Enough,
so
definitely.
Next week, we'll put a bow on the documentaries marathon with our Docs Marathon Awards. Sam, I'm suggesting the Pennebakers.
I was thinking
okay.
that this morning.
Well, I'm suggesting
yeah.
the Pennebakers, but
I
usually
like
we end up naming these after a listener suggestion.
I know.
So
where
listeners,
is the suggestion?
We're throwing it back on you. Come up with a cool name for our Docs Marathon Awards. The week after we hand out the awards, we'll kick off our much-anticipated animation marathon with Watership Down.
What about, and maybe I'm going to pronounce this because somebody pronounced this name differently, somebody that we didn't actually cover in our Ducks marathon.
Who?
Well, I was thinking of the Sales brother, the Mailses brothers.
The Maisels.
Maisels.
Yes.
Maybe the Maisels.
Maybe.
Who's the other? There was somebody else. We wanted to get into the documentaries marathon. His titles weren't really available. High School and
Frederick Wiseman.
Maybe the Wisemans.
I talked about the Wisemans is good. I talked about High School was on a recent top five.
That's
movies
right.
About high school. Great filmmaker. Maybe the Wisemans. Okay.
All right. Well, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, Adam and I turn out the lights and see who takes off running for Mommy and Daddy first. We'll reveal our top five scariest movie moments. Stay with us.
The windows cracked. It only helps my view. It's time I quit my smoking. The rent is overdue. Riding back, New York blurs my view. The tunnels made my life, being alone inside a spotlight, all on your own with a 1,000-watt light in your eyes, and the one thing you wish you could hide is shining.
You're listening to Film Spotting, and we're about to reveal our top five scariest movie moments, tying in with Halloween.
Open the blinds, because we are going to terrify you.
That's right. We're about to scare the crap out of you, or at least ourselves. So we'll get into that. We'll also explain, beyond just being Halloween, kind of where the topic came from, and we'll read some emails, or at least one email from a listener. But first, we promise some more starting over feedback. So Sam, let's deliver on that promise. Why don't you read this one from Adam?
Adam Stolberger, writing from New York. Two films where the characters start over every day. Memento and Groundhog Day.
Great choices.
Great choices.
Both
and I love the way
choices.
He terms it. That's great. That's a great pairing.
They do. Yeah, absolutely. It's great. And this one, too, I really liked Andrew Sorcini in Glendale, California. He's got what he's surprised we didn't call the Dustin Hoffman Memorial List. Kramer versus Kramer, an excellent example of a father starting over after a messy divorce. True, and D.B. Sweeney mentioned it on the show.
Yep.
Tootsie, where an out-of-work actor who can't get a job as a tomato decides to start over as a woman.
Great pick.
Rain Man, in which Tom Cruise's character, a cocky hustler, has to start over when his father dies and leaves his autistic brother, Hoffman, in his care. And, of course, The Graduate, about a post-grad whose destiny is completely planned for him by his parents and how he reboots his life by having an affair with a married woman. Andrew, you nailed it.
You nailed it, and I hate when listeners are disappointed in us.
I know. It hurts, doesn't it?
Where they're like, I was really surprised and disillusioned, you know, that you didn't have that.
Yeah.
I feel like the biggest stretch, honestly, is The Graduate. I wouldn't say that. I don't feel necessarily like
he's just starting.
He's just
more
starting.
Than just starting over.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
but
still.
He's still a good pick.
Okay,
good pick.
Certainly. How about at the end of The Graduate?
Oh, sure.
Could be arguing then you're starting over. There you go.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, top five scary moments. And this was something that I wrote about actually in last week's Dope Sheet. If you're not a Dope Sheet subscriber, you should be.
Mm-hmm.
Go to our site. You'll get all sorts of great insights into Sam Van Hollegren's personal life.
Yeah.
A peek inside our TiVos.
Things. Yes.
You know, we talk about the TV shows we love, which I know everyone wants to hear about. And you can
right.
sign up. Go to filmspotting.net and along the right rail, you can sign up for the Dope Sheet. But in it, I wrote about the fact that I was patting myself on the back for once again being a member of the Chicago Film Critics Association. And my first job as a member was to help form the top 100 scariest movies of all time
according to the Chicago Film Critics.
And I wrote about how, you know, the discrepancy between a scary movie and a horror movie. We're not going to get into any of that, but if you want to see the Chicago Film Critics list, you can go to our site, and in the notes for this show, I'll put the link to it. I'll just briefly say the top five according to Chicago Film Critics. Scary movies: Night of the Living Dead, 1968, is number five. Alien, number four. Halloween, The Exorcist, and number one, Psycho. So again, if you want to see that whole list of the 100 scariest movies, go to filmspotting.net. You'll find a link in the notes. And I wrote about some of the movies for me that scared me the most. And we got this great email, Sam, from Liz Jewerts. And she wrote in, responding to the Dope Sheet. Why don't you go ahead and take it? This really kind of inspired the top five for this week.
Yeah, Liz wrote in, the movie that absolutely traumatized me as a kid, Burnt Offerings. Oliver Reed, Karen Black, Betty Davis, a sickly, horrifying chauffeur. To this day, if you whisper, Ben, I've been waiting for you, the line uttered by Karen Black at the climax of the movie to me or my sister, we shriek. I had to use reparative therapy, she writes, to master my fear. When the movie started coming on TV every year, I watched it from the safety of my home with a soothing friend on the phone. I haven't seen it since those years and don't have any idea whether I would still like it. Like she puts in quotes, I don't think, like we said, anything that you could just term as disturbing or scarring.
Right.
I don't know if like is probably the appropriate
Maybe
word.
Not. And so the quotes are appropriate. But I'm not even going to touch that yet because my top five list is going to get into a lot of the stuff that Liz mentions. And we got a few others, too. We'll get to them certainly on the next show. Send us some voicemail. We'll play those. But really, this is one of those ideal top fives for us, I think, where it's like it's something very personal. We want to know the five moments for you that really scare you, that really still creep you out. And I think, Sam, we had a little bit of a discussion. We'll see how much your list goes into this, where I said, you know what? I'm trying to go not for nostalgia. Sure, movies creep me out when I was a kid, but like Liz said, these are movies, that's a moment that still freaks her out today. So I kind of went for moments that
I think it's still going to give you the willies a little bit.
Yeah, it's got to. So anyway, with that said, why don't you kick it off, Sam? You're 6 through 10, moments that missed the cut.
All right, a film from last year, actually, and not a horror film at all, Caché, Michael Haneke. The scenes, the flashback scenes that really don't get explained of a boy either suffering from some sense of self-mutilation or something. We get these really rapid, we're not even sure necessarily whose flashbacks they are, although probably Otoy's, but just shocking moments of horrible mutilation.
Yeah.
And then we go back to the rest of the film, which is unnerving as it is.
Well, and there is also a suicide scene in that.
Oh,
that,
totally
that
brutal.
Could qualify.
Absolutely.
Certainly.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm really going too far into this, but this is, I think, a little nostalgic, but I have to go with Poltergeist because I still occasionally will leap into my bed because of
the clown
Robbie,
under the bed.
The clown under the bed. Where, no, first shot, the clown missing from the chair, then the long arm of the clown grabbing the young boy and hauling him underneath the bed.
Yes.
Literally, I am 31, nearly 32.
Yes.
I occasionally will
hop into bed.
Or even look under the bed.
Good stuff.
Like, I'm not saying it's necessarily a clown doll. You know,
just anything,
but it could be anything.
Okay.
I've got, these are some usual suspects here, but I have Jaws, not just this first scene, which I think totally qualifies, but the scene I remember being freaked out by the most, and it's a shock kind of thing, but it's, the dismembered head floating out of the hole in the sunken ship. That's a kind of shocking scene.
Yeah, it
moment.
Is.
The final ambiguous shot in Blair Witch is a disturbing, freaky thing.
Yep.
Oh boy. I shouldn't have said this. I don't need five. Do I? Am I 6 through 10?
Sure.
After the Mary Poppins issue from last week, I'm really on fragile ground here.
More
but
feminine.
This is not a nostalgic thing. I saw this film for the first time probably 3 years ago, 3-4 years ago. I can't believe I'm going here. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I'm not saying I find it disturbing to think about now, but I remember being shocked at how scary it was and how scared it was, not even thinking of it from a child's perspective, but when the Wicked Queen morphs into this older, hunched over woman,
right,
and it's all about delivering the fatal dose of poison to Snow White, that I had a visceral response to that.
Really?
And I think I might have seen it in a big screen or something. I was just like, whoa, what's going on here?
This is
like
a kid's
1938
movie.
This is not safe for kids,
right? And your kids will not watch it.
No, they will not.
They'll wait till they're older. Okay, interesting 6 through 10, Sam. I have to give you, I had Poltergeist on here as well. The clown scene.
Yeah.
Also, there's a pool scene with Joe Beth Williams and a body of corpses in the swimming pool. And then, of course, the scene that's just gross of the character tearing off his face. That disturbs me, too. I also had the final shot, the great dream shot from Carrie. Amy Irving at Carrie's grave with the hand coming up. I also have The Ring on here, and I'm not even a huge fan of the first Ring, but I think that the first death, the first
girl we
see,
and you're talking about the American version.
The American version, the first death we see, that face when they open the door, that freaks me out. And just the video in general, I find incredibly terrifying, so it's on my list. I also have one that easily could have been, these last two easily could have been in my top five, The Shining. Danny riding his big wheel through the Overlook Hotel, coming across the two girls, and that whole sequence is really freaky. And then lastly, the moment that inspired Liz's email, really kind of talking about moments that traumatize you, and I've said it on the show before, I'll just briefly say it, it's Vampire Boy Floats Outside Window in Salem's Lot. And the only reason it's not in my top five is because I don't think it would really scare me today.
Yeah.
But when I was a kid, that was the moment you talked about, you know, jumping into your bed.
Yeah.
I still don't really sleep near windows because of Salem's Lot.
Yeah.
Because of the Vampire Boy knocking on the window saying, let me in, I'm your friend. I went my entire high school and college career making sure the blinds were always closed to my window, and I could not sleep with my
just
head near
case,
a window.
Just in case, why risk it?
Exactly.
Why not leap into bed?
Why not
keep the drapes
you
closed?
You just never know. That's a great point. I also want to say, before we get to the top five, Sam, is that I made a point, I don't know about you, that I couldn't put things on here that were moments that were simply disgusting. And if you go online, there's a website, retrocrush.com, that did its top 100 scariest movie moments, and it's a really interesting list. But they have things on there like even Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom walking through all the bugs.
Yeah.
Now, that's as disgusting and as creepy in a way as you can get for me.
You're like, yucky.
But it doesn't really scare me. Another thing I'll mention is, like in Kill Bill, I'm extremely claustrophobic, so anybody being buried alive or just the thought of it just makes me ridiculously uncomfortable.
The vanishing.
But at the same time, it's more of a discomfort than it is being scared of something.
Agreed.
So that said,
no, I think you're number five. I think it's more disturbing. All right. Number five, the first film in our horror marathon, and I still think certainly the scariest moment in that marathon. And
the door, isn't it?
The door.
In Texas Chainsaw.
The first time we see the guy approach the door slides open, the sledgehammer comes down, the kid's pulled back behind the door, and that's it? That long shot?
Yeah, of the hallway.
I think just about all of my picks here, to think about them, just give me a sense of cringing.
Of dread.
You know, dread. Yeah. There's the shock of that, but there's also just, the true, absolute horror of
it. Yep. No, that's a great choice, Sam. And I almost had it in my 6-10 because you're right. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Toby Hooper.
Yeah,
that's
plenty of scenes
the best
there,
moment.
Sure, but, yeah.
But that's
but that
really
is the
one,
best moment.
I agree. Think. Yeah.
It's distilled horror.
Yes, it is. Okay. My number five, I've mentioned this on the show before. I don't remember the context, but this really highlights, too, that difference between something being a horror film and something being just really scary and terrifying in a way. And for me, it's Blue Velvet. Number five, Frank Booth is coming up the stairs. The moment in Blue Velvet when Kyle MacLachlan, we're getting near the end of the film, and he's running down a staircase. He knows Frank is coming. He looks out the window, or is it actually, I think he just looks down the staircase. It's been a while since I've seen it. And he looks down, and Frank Booth, Dennis Hopper, is in disguise, and he looks up at him. And it seems like such a harmless moment, but I'm telling you, every time David Lynch cuts to that point of view shot of Dennis Hopper looking up, and you just know what Dennis Hopper is capable of. You know that if he catches him, what could happen. That, for me, totally, I mean, I get chills every time I see it, so it's my number five.
It's a good pick. Another marathon film, but not in the horror category, Tarkovsky's Solaris.
Okay.
Psychological terror. I mean, the scene I think of in particular, Kelvin has just got on board. He's there. He's on a mission. He's going to solve things. He goes and meets with one of the first scientists. Mm-hmm. He's in his bedroom. He's got a bunk bed.
Right.
And all we see is like a limb of a child.
Go by.
Or I think he's on the bed and crawling in the blankets or something. And we're still trying to figure out exactly, as Kelvin is, exactly what's going on here. But the scientist clearly doesn't want that to be there, is trying to pretend that's not there or is willing it not to be there. It's totally unexplained every time we see a child just like walking along the hallways of that spaceship. Again, another case of thinking about it now, it's
creepy.
Horrifying.
And you know, because Kelvin knows how many people are on this.
Yeah, exactly.
Ship.
There are no children.
There's nobody. No extra. People.
And the fact that they're not phantoms, they're real flesh.
Yeah.
And just the movement of the limb through like the blanket
is
somehow the most horrifying aspect.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, my number four, Sam, you had it in your 6-10. It is the closing shot of the Blair Witch Project. And I know there may be some listeners who are real horror buffs going, "Oh, the Blair Witch sucks. How can that be scary?" And I'll even mention, I told you that site, Retro Crush. I think that's it, retrocrush.com. They had a Blair Witch scene in there that it's the one where, you know, who's at the outside of the tent. That moment for them was there. And here's what the person on Retro Crush wrote. "While many folks point to the end of the Blair Witch Project as one of the scariest scenes in film, it always makes me laugh. The abrupt ending where the guy is just standing there against the wall looks like he's taking a piss." Well, you know what? Fair enough.
Fine.
But it terrifies me. Yeah. That moment of all the moments in Blair Witch for me, because it sort of actually makes then everything they've been saying, this legend of the Blair Witch, real.
Yeah.
And just the way it's done where she walks down the stairs and you just see briefly that shot and then the way the camera goes up. Yeah. That freaked the hell out of me, so
I totally agree, and I put
it
on there, too. And I mean, Blair Witch itself did not scare me at all. It was totally post-hype. I actually just liked watching it.
Yes, I did, too.
I liked the acting. I liked the way it was shot, the whole, you know, DIY thing. I just liked the whole thing.
Yes.
The artifice of it. And I was totally freaked out by the end.
Right.
And that may have been the one moment, and that was enough.
Well, just briefly let me add, too, that for me, it's a horror, a general fear of mine as well, of just, like, going into dark places.
No question.
And it comes back to, I mean, there was a moment when I was a kid, young, very young kid. We had a big two-story house, and my mom will tell you the story that she woke up one night to the sounds of me screaming, just screaming for mom, because I was I had slept walked from my upstairs bedroom down to the basement, and I was standing in a pitch.
Yikes.
I was standing in a pitch black basement at the bottom of the stairs, just screaming. And she had to come down and get me. And so that stuff for me, I've always been kind of traumatized by that. And so just them, her walking in the darkness into that room, into that basement.
There's plenty of cases to be made for not revealing your vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
And I don't know why we're doing it here.
I don't know.
I mean,
either.
If anybody wanted to traumatize us, they know how to do it. But I have the same fear. I still, not only do I occasionally, yes, leap into bed.
Uh-huh.
I run up the stairs out of the basement.
Nice.
Lights off downstairs.
Oh, yeah.
I will just sort of just gently, I won't do a leisurely walk up the stairs. I had a similar incident sleepwalking, but I didn't walk down the stairs. I actually fell down the basement stairs.
Nice. Well, that'll bother you as well.
That'll trouble you.
You know what?
Falling, hurtling down towards the basement floor.
Quick, again, another quick basement story. Thriller. I was in second
Michael
grade when Thriller, Michael Jackson's Thriller,
mm-hmm.
I was watching it for the first time. I remember I was talking to my friend Matt on the phone, on our basement phone. It's daylight.
The first time you're watching
It's
Thriller.
Daylight, yeah, but the first time I'm watching Thriller. And I remember watching it, and all of a sudden, he goes down to the ground, and he comes up with the yellow eyes and says, "Leave me alone," or get away. He says, "Get away," I think.
Yeah.
That moment, I remember, I mean, I'm talking to a friend on the phone, and that happens, and I remember literally just putting the phone down. Like, I didn't even say, I didn't even give an explanation. I just put the phone down and ran up the stairs. It scared me that much. So, okay.
But unfortunately,
anyway.
He wasn't privy to the yelp of horror.
No,
but
he wasn't.
Just...
Okay.
All right. You mentioned it in your 6 through 10, and I may have a similar feeling about The Ring. But in terms of how good is the film, I don't know anymore. But I don't know. I don't know anymore. But just like you said, just the tape itself, watching the tape, and I think that's where my sort of lingering respect for Verbinski comes from. It's like he was able to truly terrorize me or craft a document, that videotape that was scary enough. But Samara crawling out of the well towards the TV screen,
mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, thinking about it now still freaks me
it's
out.
It's good stuff.
Qualifies.
Okay, quickly, I'm cheating a little bit, but I've cheated before with this movie or this series, and I'll say simply Twin Peaks. I'll throw in Fire Walk With Me. Actually, because it is Fire Walk With Me that is the scariest moment for me. I've got another David Lynch on here. David Lynch, you know, with Bob in general in Twin Peaks, anytime Bob's on screen during the TV series, it terrified me. But really, the moment that really sticks out for me is from Fire Walk With Me, where there's a shot where Laura Palmer has this vision of going back to her bedroom, and there's a scene of the camera panning around the room, and you see Bob is actually there. She's realizing that Bob was in her room, like behind her dresser, and he's got that Bob evil look on his face. And, you know, you go back to the series, too. Just there's a shot in the series where the kids are in the living room, Laura Flynn Boyle, and they're doing a school project, and Bob appears crawling over the couch towards them. Terrifying stuff. Bob is
scary. I recall, yes, our good friend Kevin Ridge.
Kevin Ridge, who will actually be on our show.
Next week. He's getting married next week.
Yes.
But he would actually, when you were roommates in college,
he would try to terrify me by, at night, close the door, shut off the light, and crawl across the couch. And
these are not friends. With friends like these, the saying goes.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
All right, I've got two pretty standard issue picks coming up. First, number two, Rosemary's Baby. For me, the final scene. Yes, we have the horrible Satan impregnating Mia Farrow, but really for me, it's that final scene because it's just the look of everyone's face
mm-hmm.
once it's been revealed. And as she goes over to the bassinet, what have you done to it?
Right,
what
exactly.
What have you done to its eyes?
Great, great scene.
Ruth Gordon,
oh yeah,
lover.
Yep, they're all good there. I've got a tie for my number two because they're very similar. Again, not horror films, actually both detective movies, serial killer movies. That's the tie-in here for these films. I've got Manhunter and Seven. There is a scene in Seven, the sloth scene. And again, this one almost qualifies as just being disgusting, but there's a genuine fright there of when they go and find Sloth, this character that Kevin Spacey's character has basically kept alive, rotting in a really disgusting fashion. And the fact is, they of course assume he's dead. He looks like he has to be dead. And then he jolts. There's a jolt of action. And I don't know that I've ever jumped more in my seat than that moment, because I've never been more repulsed watching a movie than that moment, and then to realize that he's still alive. And then you think about the other fear, the thing that makes it fearful is this idea that someone went through the process of keeping that person alive. That just creeps me out even more. So that scene is great, and also Manhunter. I wrote about this briefly in the Dope Sheet. There's a scene in Manhunter, the original Red Dragon, William Peterson, where Michael Mann's film, he has to kind of re-envision how this murder happened. This family was slaughtered in their upstairs bedroom. And he goes into this house at night, just like the murderer would have. The second he walks in the house, walking into a dark house where a family was murdered, I'm totally on edge and freaked out. And then he goes upstairs and he starts re-envisioning how it happened. And there's just a shot of a character of, I think he's envisioning like the father having to watch his family die, and the bad guy, the Tooth Fairy, puts like a piece of mirror in their eyes. You see this quick shot all of a sudden of this, of the mirrors in their eyes, like this dead character's eyes sparkling. It's over.
It's over for you.
It's over for me. It's still over for me right now at this point. I could not watch it.
I wish I could do that trick where I put mirrors in my eyes, but I can't.
I know
pull
you
that can. Off.
Okay, number one.
Number one. You had it in your 6 through 10. I'm sorry, but The Shining, Danny riding around his tricycle and running
Why
into
do
the
you
two
do that,
girls.
Danny?
They want to play with us forever and ever.
Uh-huh.
The two, it's a nostalgia thing, but also the entire film creeps me out. I hear a selection of the music, and I'm done for. Particularly that scene when we see his face. Is that when he opens the door to the room and we see his face, like
yeah.
the face of a disturbed person?
Yeah,
that I can recall that look. But when I saw, I remember it was on TV, I think, and I don't know why I was out of my room. My parents were watching it on TV, and that image of the two girls
right.
followed by the, you know, the river of blood through
yes.
the hallways. That's not something you should see when
no.
you're 9 years old.
No.
I remember going to my brother's room, 3 years my junior, and I think I recently brought him up by, you know, he had to play short round to
uh-huh.
my Indiana Jones.
Shortstop to your Indiana Jones.
To shortstop, exactly.
Uh-huh.
And so here I was, moment of terror. I needed some comfort. I needed to sleep in bed with him.
Uh-huh.
And he totally denies me. I feel like there weren't many times when he got me. I needed him most, and he turned
yeah.
me away from my terror.
Well, you want to hear something even worse? Imagine not having a younger brother, but only younger
only
sisters.
Younger sisters.
And looking for that comfort
to.
And that protection, Sam. What does that make me? Okay.
Know.
Well,
Mary Poppins,
yeah,
finally.
Mary Poppins, I guess. Well, my number one, simply, I don't know that there's a specific moment. I'm just going to say The Exorcist. It was my number one horror film. It's the movie that still creeps me out, like Liz. I had to watch this movie when I had graduated from college with friends around just to like go through the experience of having seen it and facing my fear, because it goes back to a childhood thing of you talk about with your parents. I remember being, I think I've told the story before, but I remember being in my room listening to the Empire Strikes Back soundtrack. So this is circa, what, 83 or something?
It's gotta be.
I'm like 8 years old. I'm reading a book about Star Wars. My parents are in the other room watching The Exorcist on television. I can hear her voice from the other room, and it's
enough.
Freaking me out, and that was enough. And I just remember moments of even being in high school, flipping channels late at night, being like 8th or 9th grade, flipping channels, landing on even a single shot of Linda Blair's face when she's really become the demon and the yellow eyes and everything, and I just instantly like want to run up to mom and dad's room and sleep in their bed.
Or younger sisters, yeah.
Or younger sisters if I have to. So The Exorcist for me, it's my number one, and again, there could be any number of moments that I could pick. So.
I knew it would be there. All right, well, that is our top five. Send in your top five or any other feedback you may have to feedback@filmspotting.net. Opening in wide release this weekend, Borat, Flushed Away, and The Santa Claus 3, The Escape Clause. We'll have reviews, of course, of The Santa Claus 3. And no, he won't. Of Borat and Clint Eastwood's Flags of Our Fathers on next week's show, along with the documentary Marathon Awards, the Maleses.
The Maisels or the Pennebakers.
Yeah,
or
the
hopefully
Pennebakers.
Someone will come up with something better.
Something better. And our top five, Strangers in a Strange Land culture clash movies.
There you go. Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. It is a new month. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. Also on our blog, sign up for the aforementioned Dope Sheet, our weekly email blast. Thanks to the Blue Jackets and also Ed Burns and Aaron Lubin. Ed Burns is producer Aaron. The Blue Jackets were featured in the movie The Groomsmen, and they sent along this CD from the Blue Jackets, so we thank them for today's music. You can check out the Blue Jackets on the web at thebluejackets.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Swap your unwanted DVDs for the ones you really want at peerflix.com/filmspotting. They nailed it shut.
Good. I don't like sellers. Probably just some garbage down there anyways.
You know she's a woman, right, Sam? Do you want to maybe try that again?
I had a lot to drink last night. This is how I talk.
You want to try it again?
You want me to do my woman voice?
Yes, I do.
All right.
Okay. I'm all about authenticity here, Sam. Are you ready?
You're right.
I'm giving you another shot. Okay.
And action.
They nailed it shut.
Good. I don't like Sellers.